as well as any of the verticals. And he more or less told me that I really don't know what I'm talking about, that they've made tests galore, and that their vertical will outperform any ordinary dipole, no matter what configuration you put it into. So I don't know if you want to comment on that, Dick. I got really an earful that our comments really from this supposedly SETI's chief antenna engineer for this company, that we are not taking a number of things into consideration, Dick. Over.
I sort of suspect we're going to get into this one now. Where I express my opinions about quarter-wave ground plane type antennas, and I'm a little bit down on them, and there are people out there selling them. It's one of the more expensive kinds of ham radio antenna. So therefore, my comments, if people believe me, and I'm expressing an opinion, not exactly hard fact in this area. We're into a delicate area of what kind of antenna do you prefer? Do you like blondes or brunettes? Do you like dipoles or ground planes? It's almost that kind of a decision, if you know what I mean. Yes, I can be affecting somebody's business. And a person in business selling antennas is going to make a lot more money selling ground plane antennas with all the fancy coils on them, as opposed to dipoles. You can't make very much money selling dipoles. And if the man is selling a vertical ground plane-like antenna that is, and its radiator more in the vicinity of a half-wave radiator than a quarter-wave radiator, without a doubt he's going to have a lot more performance for the size of the antenna and the dollars invested. I'm a strong believer in half-wave-like vertical antennas, half-wave, 5/8 wave, whatever, as opposed to quarter wave. Quarter wave only works well when you've got a whole lot of ground plane radials out there, like maybe 32 of them, all of them quarter wavelength long. And not all of us have got the real estate to do that, particularly not on 80 or 160. So vertical antennas that are more like half wave and 5/8 can definitely give you more performance. However, a antenna that you never see, let me drop, an antenna that you never see in any of the construction manuals is an elevated half-wave antenna, vertically polarized. You never see it. And it's an antenna that I'm convinced hasn't been given a fair chance. So if I was a new amateur, and I'm reasonably well-heeled with money, and I can go out and buy one of the better brands of vertical half-wave-like ground plane antenna, I'm going to be reasonably happy. Quarter-wave, if I don't lay down enough radials, I'll be getting relatively low performance, but I don't know it, because you can't measure radiation efficiency easily. It's a very difficult measurement. I can only measure standing wave ratio and bandwidth and things like that. I can't measure whether or not the 100 watts I put into the antenna, only 20 watts is going into space and 80 watts is heating up the local soil or going into some other direction that's not doing me any good. I can't easily measure that. But I'm saying that for a guy who is reasonably well off, he can be quite happy with a half-wave-like vertical ground plane antenna. For the guy who doesn't have much money now, an ordinary half-wave dipole is going to give him a lot of bang for the money. A vertical half-wave dipole is also going to give him a lot of bang for the money, particularly because he can now elevate it above the ground higher than he could have put the half-wave ground plane. So, pays your money, takes your choice. I'm expressing opinions. I'm not exactly traceable to the Bureau. I'm telling you what my experience says. Bell is telling you what his experience says. And you listen to us, try to understand what we're saying, talk to other people whose opinions you respect, read the literature, and there's a little bit of a hard part now. You've got to be careful what literature you read. Some of what you read on the TechNet, some of what you read on the internet is not accurate information. Some of what you read from antenna manufacturers is inaccurate information. It's no secret that QST Magazine will not put the gain claim of any antenna in any of their advertisements. They've been burned too often. Too many of the antenna manufacturers made claims for the game that were way beyond the laws of physics.
Repeater, time out.
So rather than offend antenna manufacturer A versus antenna manufacturer B, I mean, what was going on here is that many manufacturers realized that a brand new ham looks at all the available antennas, looks how many dollars, looks how many dB of gain, and he goes for the one that gives him the most number of dB of gain per dollar. So realizing that, many antenna manufacturers were setting the gain in the advertising department, not in the measurement laboratory. And some of those gain claims were huge. And they were great big fibs and lies. And so QST got around that problem by saying, say anything you want about the antenna, wind survival, weight, dollars, wind load, shininess, diameter, whatever. But don't tell us what the gain is. We're not going to publish it. There's too much controversy there. So as you can tell, there's a bit of a tainted past when it comes to antenna manufacturers on that very important parameter, beam width and antenna gain. In fact, some manufacturers didn't realize that that the directivity of the antenna, the gain, and the beam width obey certain laws of necessary but not sufficient, and they weren't obeying those laws even. And so, as I said, they were beyond physics. So I can see how you're going to get some flack on that one, Mel. So you guys have to occasionally use a second and third opinion. Mel and Dick have some opinions, and that's not the whole story. And in many cases, I will say something negative about a particular antenna, and maybe you're going to find that two of your guys in your particular ham club have got that exact antenna and love it. And so you gotta try to get the whole picture. It's not easy. When there's 5,000 kinds of antennas, Mel and Dick are going to be, and their friends are going to be in love with certain ones and not in love with certain others. And we express our opinions. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2IL.
K2Yankee Oscar, I think it is. Start off with your name. I should know you very well. And tell me your opinion, sir.
Is that really allowed? Back over to you, Dick.
Excellent suggestion. Wow, you hit the nail on the head, Greg. Wow. Glenn, I'm sorry. There's somebody with a very similar set of call letters I know named Greg. Glenn, you're absolutely right. There is one of the very high rules of the FCC, and the top of the list is there should be no pecuniary interest. So if the guy's got a commercial product, he's not allowed to come on ham radio and advertise it, which gives him remuneration, so to speak. Yep, okay. Hey, Bernie. Bernie, who had this beautiful sounding suggestion, and I just loved the sound of it at first. Now what do you think we should do, Bernie? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
Well, you know, it's all good fun until one of the adults gets in and makes us abide by the rules. Hi. Now, it's a really good point, Glenn. Obviously, I hadn't thought this all the way through, but it'd be very interesting to get some kind of a forum to, when somebody's got a detraction, let them come on and discuss it. So we'll have to ruminate over this idea some more and figure out some legal way to do this. K2YO.
And I'm with you. There's got to be a way of making it more legal. I mean, you take, for instance, one of the strict rules about no remuneration with ham radio. In the beginning, before cell phones really became popular, the way that the hams had a touch tone pad and they would connect it to the handy talkie to a local repeater, and therefore they could make a telephone calls through the repeater. And that's perfectly fine, but what happens if a guy calls a local pizza shop by that means and orders a pizza? It was in a sticky area, and the FCC eventually allowed it. I'm not quite sure how we get around this one. Back to you, Glenn, for any further suggestion. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yes, he has a family representative with a ham license. Back over to you.
Dick, there's another station trying to get in there from outside.
Yeah, that's Joe, and we got to pause long enough and get Joe in. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, listening on and off here. Wouldn't the basic thing be if the guy is actually making money off the conversation he's bringing up, or if he's discussed it more in a technical nature, just discuss his product? If he's actually making money off it, that's one thing. If he's discussing it just for the technical nature, like he doesn't agree with what you're saying, I think that's a different story, isn't it?
Hey, Joe, great suggestion. Okay. If I talk about the effectiveness and the efficiency of radiation of a quarter wave light ground plane flat on the ground with a small number of ground plane radials, and if he's got another good authoritative source, and there are people out there like Jerry Civic, I can't think of his call letters, but Jerry Civic has done a lot of research and appeared on the front cover of QSD magazine on multiple occasions for electrically small quarter-wave ground plane antennas and what efficiency he was measuring with those antennas and the fancy balloning techniques he had to use in order to feed those very low impedances that you get. So the Jerry Civic material, W2CMI is it? I'll eventually think of his call letters. So, say that again.
Fox Mary, India.
W2FMI. Fox Mary, India. Okay. Jerry Civic had some good information. So when you go back to a darn good resource like that and compare, and you got a good suggestion there, Joe. So I can be expressing an opinion from the literature I've read, and the man can address it technically as opposed to, our brand advertises this game and brand B advertises that game. I agree with you, Joe. I think you got a good one there. Okay. So it looks like somebody read you the Riot Act a little bit over the phone there, Bill. And I guess that person felt that we and our opinions, or at least my opinion, was somewhat attacking his particular product. K2KEY, K2LIW.
K2JX.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if we're talking about amateur radio antennas, that's one thing. Chances are a manufacturer's representative is going to be a ham. He's going to know the rules anyway, but you work for antenna specialists. Let's say you're working on a particular project and talk about it on the radio. You know, the gray area of advertising is not so gray. I mean, you can make pretty easy logical sense out of it. And, you know, the person is ham and coming and joining us, then, you know, you really don't have anything to worry about there. Although, hey, if I make something and I think it's better than what you make, I'm going to say that. But, you know, that's just life. You know, I just wanted to give you my opinion. And by the way, the FCC did actually rule on that many years back. And as long as it was not something that you're conducting a regular business, an incidental thing like calling the drugstore or calling for a pizza, is something that's part of life, and they considered that to be an easy thing to do. So there you go.
So phone patching for a pizza call and the drugstore call to have a delivery was considered legal. In other words, no huge amount of money is flowing because of that, and it's not something that takes place 40 times during the day for a business running a dispatching service for his home delivery. Understand, if you're running a taxi cab business on ham radio and you're dispatching your cabs by way of ham radio, you're going to get in trouble. But a guy in Brooklyn who doesn't do that is K2KUI. Go ahead, Mel, and where's the next... give us a couple of hints as to, if you want to, as to how much of a riot act was read to you, and go ahead with your next mailbag antenna question, if that's what you'd like to do. You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KUI. Well, that's what the discussion I tried to... I said, you want to have a peaceful discussion, talk like a gentleman and everything, and not scream in a phone. I said, I more or less, you know, less want to just further discuss it with you. This company, I told them, in fact, I did tell them, I said, you can come on here, one means or another, because it's not a, not local here in the tri-state area, tell us, as long as you don't mention the company that you represent and the product, but tell us what, you know, type of technical design your vertical is based on, and why you feel that this type of design will be superior to any simple type of antenna, such as we mentioned, a dipole or a sloper or a vertically polarized dipole, any of those configurations of dipoles, and give us your opinion as to why. And I said, that would be easy. Well, right away, you don't understand principles of antennas, neither one of you. That if you take and start with elevated feed, you right away have the advantage, right? Well, that's been something that I know has been discussed in QSC in detail about verticals with elevated feed. Supposedly, they have, some people have made that they've gotten some very unusual characteristics from that kind of antennas and all, and the theory of performance and everything, and, you know, a number of things. But I am not convinced that just because you use elevated feed on a vertical, that's going to make it, you know, make it a night and day comparison with a dipole deck over.
Who is that? Give us your full call letter, sir.
November 2 X-ray Zulu here, coming to the IRS. I have a question, one of you guys.
Okay, November 2, X-ray Zulu Sierra. Your audio is very low, but we're hearing you. And you said you have a question. And after Mel gives us his first mailbag, we'll come back to that question. Okay, so an elevated feed. There have been a significant number of articles over the years in QST, among other places, where instead of feeding a quarter-wave ground plane at the bottom, you either move it toward half-wave resonator, where the phase center is now elevated, and there's been various articles written where people have distributed loading coils and trap-like mechanisms throughout the radiator, such that they believe they're extending the length of radiator where significant current is flowing and or making the phase center higher above the normal position, and they believe that significant benefit comes from that. Without a doubt, the benefit can come from some of those techniques, but are we talking about a 2 dB improvement or a 20 dB improvement? If the person is claiming a 20, I'm going to say I'm very skeptical. If he's claiming a 1 or a 2 dB improvement, I think it's very, very possible. And if I take a purely vertical half-wave piece of wire and either feed it at the center and live with the mechanical difficulty of bringing the feed line off to one side to do that, or use a little bit more smarts and feed it at the end where the impedance is 2,000 ohms, but now I can hang it in my tree at a much higher altitude, but it's really a simple half-wave vertical dipole. Which one's going to give me more bang for the money? That particular antenna I just mentioned is one that has never been properly represented in the literature. Very few amateurs have tried it. I didn't say it's super easy, but I think there's a lot to be offered. And essentially no ground plane radios are required, so life gets very simple, and the materials are not expensive. Just an unconventional way of doing things. And which is going to work better for you? Well, we can have a discussion on that one. Over to you, Mel, with your first real question, if you want to go there. K2LIW.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, I heard you beautifully, Ed, on the input, but the machine was in its timeout mode. Why don't you repeat the misstatement you just said, Ed, go ahead.
My comment is, don't argue with me. Show me the patterns you made on an antenna range. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. You can yell all the lexicon you want. It all comes down to what's the pattern.
Ed, who was that mystery voice? Ed, would you like to identify yourself?
No, but I guess I have to. WB2EAV.
And that was Ed Gellender, one of the engineers at Northrop Grumman. Maybe I shouldn't be revealing that, but one of the guys who I've had many discussions with over the years. Certainly well done. Yeah, if the antenna really is superior, an antenna range measurement, certainly a beautiful way of doing it. At HF frequencies, a good antenna range is not, the words roll off the tongue a lot easier than really doing it. We amateurs, in many cases, are forced to do an alpha-bravo test, as I call it. In other words, you've got a dipole that you're calling your reference at hopefully the same, nearly the same location and nearly the same altitude compared to your antenna in question. And you talk to your buddy a mile away or 10 miles away or 1,000 miles away over the telephone or whatever, another channel, and say, I'm now using antenna alpha, and now I'm using antenna bravo. Tell me what your S-meter says, assuming the guy's got a reasonably well-calibrated S-meter. Or you can even calibrate the S-meter for him. Hey, I'm giving you 1 watt now, I'm giving you 10 watts now, or I'm giving you 100 watts now. Tell me what your S-meter reads. Long as there isn't huge QSB, you can do a real remote field measurement test like that and get some pretty strong evidence as to which antenna is working better. Yeah, I know there's a lot of variables as to what is the state of the ionosphere today, how fast is it changing, and is the guy at the right range, and so on. But still, gather enough evidence of that form. Even though you don't have a good antenna range, I guarantee it'll start giving you some kind of a compendium of opinion as to how good that antenna really is. I wonder how you would do it, Ed, to the B2EAV, if you had to qualify an antenna, K2RIW, would you change what I just said? You got it, Ed.
You're absolutely right, but remember, let's not talk oranges and apples. You were talking earlier about an antenna design concept that is supposed to be superior. There's no reason you can't scale that, particularly if you're talking about a company that wants to sell it, so it has some resources available. It's not being done on a shoestring. Scale the design to a frequency where you can put it on an antenna range that's, you know, not an absurdity, that it is actually affordable to take, have a professional people take professional data for your professional product.
Boy, am I glad I asked you that question. Well done. Well done. Extremely good chunk of history on just doing that. Arguably one of the world's best experts on modern-day Yagi design is Dr. Gunter Hock, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform in Darmstadt, Germany. Is that where he lives? I think it is. Anyhow, he has taken almost everybody's respected Yagi design on planet Earth, scaled it to the 432 megacycle ham band, his favorite ham band. Maybe he's done some of them on 1296, but a lot of them on 432. Brought it into his research laboratory. He works for the Research Institute of the German Federal Postal Office. He brings it into that anechoic chamber and measures it. with instrumentation that's traceable to his Bureau of Standards. Man, that's data that's getting pretty darn close to bedrock. And you can have a lot of faith in it. So he doesn't care if the Yagi is on 80 meters or on 10 gigahertz. He scales it to 432, and one of the universal laws of antennas is that if you scale every single dimension, diameters, boom diameters, element diameters, and spacings, if you scale every dimension proportional to your favorite wavelength, in theory you get the exact same antenna performance and gain, beamwidth, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, whatever you want to measure, polarization characteristics. Do a good job of scaling, you get the exact same performance at the new frequency. And he has an antenna range, a chamber, that he knows what it can do at that frequency, and he scaled everything to it. He's got quite a significant number of articles in the German magazine on just how to do that. And he's got this beautiful plot of all the world's best Yagis, and he's come up with a very nice formula. Let me drop it. Where you tell him what is the boom length, and he'll tell you what gain capability a Yagi-like structure on that number of wavelengths of boom, what is it capable of giving you. And there are people who believe that super wide spacing of the elements, there are other people who believe in super narrow spacing of the elements, tapered the elements, whatever. Once you fix the number of wavelengths of boom, Gunter has discovered there's sort of a maximum amount of gain that you can realize by stacking elements in there, and that's about all you're going to do. There's no other magic beyond that point by all the experiments he has done by modeling of all the world's best Yagi designs. Anybody with any further questions or comments on what I just said, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. Mel, back to you. And dig into that mailbag if you want to. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I got that earful also. I should do my homework and look at the specs on the antennas and the testing that is done. And I did glance somewhat, but I'm somewhat still not sure that some of the information was conjecture. That, yes, I saw there was accuracy there, but some of the performance data, you know, how it performs in actuality on the air performance maybe could be a little bit exaggerated at times, because I don't think it's going to make a difference any of type of antenna of this sort compared to a dipole, that you're going to be a difference between actually hearing a DX station or not hearing them at all because of certain characteristics that they feel vertical antenna will have over a dipole. Well, that's the final word, like I say. The person who's listening, you want to come on and debate this, don't mention, you don't have to make any mention of the company that you work for or product. And as Dick says, just pure technical, tell us how we're wrong in our conjecture that what we just basically said. Okay, let me try another one, Dick. Okay, here's a question that's come up a number of times from young people. I particularly always look for young people, teenagers, and all interested. You gentlemen have talked many a times how you started out in the field of electronics, fixing televisions, radio televisions, and you got a lot of experience. Well, that's sort of gone now. I am interested. I've gotten very fascinated with the field of electronics, and I was wondering, do you think it is a viable field for the future, that electrical engineering does have a real future, especially in this country being outsourced? Seems like most all the companies are sending their projects overseas. Number of companies, countries coming up are really seems to be taking over most. Job has just basically disappeared. What is your opinion? Do you think it is viable for the future? Well, what do you think, Dick?
Don, good question. And with the raw data, with the raw data, the first is going to happen. that a person is going to have with what's available to them right now. You're going to see I'm working with a different input where I'm getting a lot of delay, and therefore you're going to hear some delays in my speech. I'm hearing my own speech fed back to me 2 seconds delayed. Yes, a lot of stuff is being outsourced, and that would lead you to believe we're no longer doing any real electrical engineering in the United States. Absolutely not true. Even though you may be buying your material from Southeast Asia, Taiwan, Bangalore, India, or the software you're buying in Ireland, no matter what you're doing outsourcing, you still have to have somebody locally who understands the technology and knows what he's buying. He's got to write a requirement specification that describes what they want and what is the criteria for proving that it's working correctly. There's still a need for RF engineers. Stand by a second. Okay, and then if the person keeps doing it, I'll flip back again and do it the same way. He's going to keep doing it, so.
Thank you, we can repeat it, Jim. This little dog came on.
Okay, I'll do it this way. Make the decision. This is a subject he loves. He wants to do it, and he's willing to expend the effort required to join that, to acquire that skill. That's my spin on it. My guess is, Mel, that you got into electronics and wireless electronics by a somewhat similar process. Age 14 or something like that, that you developed a love of the subject and you went into the profession regardless of whether or not it paid well. We could all get a lot of experience way back in the 50s because all television receivers had marginal reliability and we all had to do a lot of repair. The good news is modern televisions are so darn reliable that very little repair is going on. So going into the radio and television repair business is no longer very viable for a person getting into electronics. But still, there are other ways you can get into it. I'm having a little trouble figuring out now how to do that. Maybe Mel can tell me. What's your suggestion, Mel, as to how a person just starting out in electronics can acquire the skill that we're talking about? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. This is a problem. A lot of places, of course. You walk in there, and what kind of experience situation is for many people right now that they're coming out of school, abundant maybe right now considering the situation and economic situation, and many of them cannot get jobs. In fact, unfortunately, I do get calls from people that are been in fact in the field for a number of years right now and find that they can't find anything really that pays well enough. You happen to have a specialty and that is in demand, but unfortunately there are specialties, also other specialties in electronics right now that are not in great demand. As you say, the outsourcing is one of the problems that causing tremendous loss in the industry of jobs. And for young people, a person is, it's difficult. That's all I ever did in my life. I mean, I never had any other hobbies or whatever other than started out as a little kid, really, with wires and crystal sets and all. So the only thing I've really had any interest in my entire life, so, and I grew up like you at the right time, Dick. Possibly that's it. We were at the right place at the right time. I really don't have an answer. What do you do in today's world? You got to put a lot of effort in. It does require putting a lot of, as they say, burning a lot of midnight oil and putting your mind to it and all your nose to the grindstone, however you want to express it. But, can I guarantee you're going to come out and get a job? This I can't answer because, fortunately, I am getting calls from constituents right now by asking me if I know of any openings, Dick, over.
I'm getting them also, Mel, and in many cases I can't help. I have some idea. There are certain skills that companies have job orders open for right now, saying that if you can find me a person with that skill, I'll hire 3, 4, or 5 of them. But they're very special skills. There's one other advantage that kids have today that you and I didn't have. Tremendous amount of knowledge. 98% of it, very good stuff, is available on the internet. You Google certain key words, and boy, all of a sudden you'll get 5,000 hits on that subject, and you start going through them. Many of the Wikipedias will give you an extremely nice explanation of very esoteric phenomena. Choose any word that you'd like to know about and Google that word plus Wikipedia. And 95% of the time, Wikipedia will give you a beautiful explanation. It is a kind of online evolving textbook is what Wikipedia is from my point of view. Wikipedia has a couple of errors, but some expert is eventually going to sign in and say, hey, let's modify it this way and make it more accurate. And most of what you read there is extremely good stuff. So you and I, the only thing we had available to us was the local library, and you hope it was a good technical library, or your own personal collection of books is all we really had in our day. That was our disadvantage. The advantage we had is that everybody was starting to learn about radio and television, and they all needed repair, and we were supplying that repair service. So it was a cash flow for us, and also a way of meeting your neighbors and becoming very friendly with them. They treated you very well if you could maintain their television and radios and phonographs and so on. Nowadays, all the electronics we buy is so darn reliable, it almost never fails. Therefore, we can't be in the repair business anymore. But still, if you decide on your own to study the subject, and you use the best books you can buy, the best books you can buy in a used bookstore, the best books you can buy in a flea market, and the best stuff that's on the internet and in your local library, there's a lot of very good information on any subject you might be interested in. I remember Googling recently high voltage experiments. I Googled that. Boy, I got a whole lot of hits that told me about Van de Graaff generators and Tesla coils and Wimshurst machines and electrostatics and whatever, and ways of using a microwave oven, using and misusing a microwave oven, and its high voltage and high power microwaves and doing whatever. So choose any subject you want. Use the right combinations of words on the internet with Google, among other kinds of search engines, and tremendous amount of information is there. So you have to do quite a bit of study on your own. You got to do your homework. Talk to people who know the subject, take the courses, buy the books, read what's available to you on the internet, and so whatever your favorite subject is, you can become a minor expert in it if you're willing to make the dedication. Once you make the transition into becoming a minor expert on that subject and you properly advertise your wares, and maybe that advertisement is a website that you establish on the internet, people will then eventually beat a path to your door. That's an opinion. It has worked for me. I'm a member. Let me drop.
Gotcha.
I'm now also a member of the Long Island Consultants Network, the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network, which consists of something like 40 people who have got, on average, 20 or more years of experience in a particular field. And so they teach each other how to run a consulting business. And they also provide for me a website that allows me to advertise what are the properties you get if you decide to hire a K2RIW. And extremely high percentage of the knowledge that I have about wireless, I learned through ham radio. The colleges I went to, gave me the degree, the piece of sheepskin, the paper, that allows me to call myself an engineer or a consultant. So the authority came from the college. The knowledge came from ham radio. 90-some-odd% of the knowledge that I use to do my daily work, unfortunately, some of the basics came from the college, but the real working information, the day-to-day information, primarily came from ham radio. That's the way it was for me. I wonder how it was for you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Same, basically the same way. We came up the same time, Dick, so we're a very similar path. And like you say, yes, we did put our time in to do our homework on one end, but we did also, on the other hand, we were involved with hands-on. And that there's no way to, you know, get the, like you say, the hands-on experience without putting your hands on, so that is an important factor to, you know, get beyond just the book learning, which is important. I'm not going to put that down. It's the knowledge that I was able to, you know, receive from going to Brooklyn Technical High School and then going on to college was indispensable, definitely. But like Dick said, if you have a pure love for it, amateur radio or electronics in general and all, you will, you know, be able to shine, as they say, in the industry. You'll be something that gets a reputation that people will know about it. Unfortunately, we are going through some bad times right now, so it's not a good representation right now, but I think that will change. I believe it will change, and I'm sure that in the future, it'll be even a bigger field because there's so much more to come. Oh, boy, we have just begun. really, you think that it's fabulous now, the field of electronics, computers, and I think we have just beginning to see, as they say, the tip of the iceberg. Okay, that's my opinion also, Dick. I think, shall we go on to the next one?
Okay, I'm going to get
And by the way, each one of these periods where there is a depression, a recession, a depression, or whatever, they only last for a relatively small period of time, 1-2 years. And then all of a sudden the economy recovers again. This country is a very resilient thing. It will come back. We can argue, is it going to come back in 6 months or in 18 months? It will come back. So these hard times are temporary hard times. And you study the past records, you would think that the newspaper reports would lead you to believe that the crash of 1939, the crash of 39, I think it was, that everybody was jumping out of the windows and committing suicide. In reality, the suicide rate during that period of time went down. People were all in the same boat, hanging together. It's during times of prosperity when people really do crazy things, opposite of common sense. You've got it, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, 1929, the famous crash, of course, that really started a depression that, thank God, we're not going through that extreme right now. There's built-in provisions that the government did, you know, built-in system learning at that time, of course, such as Social Security and a number of other factors, but at least, you know, it's... not as severe as what I heard what went on in the 30s. Yeah, you know, Dick, you know, somebody sent me also that it seems that the economic recession periods or whatever seem to coincide with solar waters times that they said, well, they could have predicted that we're going to go through this because the sunspot cycle, the solar water, is very intense right now, that we have had no beginning of a new cycle. And they said if they look back in the recessions of we had back in the 80s, back in the 50s and everything, it also coincides with the solar mortar. Do you believe that, over?
You got to be careful. If you've got a small amount of data, because we haven't had that many depressions, if you've got a small amount of data, and you got a lot of ways of looking at it, you're going to find a correlation. Now, is that correlation real or coincidental? So, is there a relationship between the stock market and the sunspot cycle? I'm skeptical, but I won't say it's impossible. And if you do think that there is a correlation, please tell me what you believe is the coupling mechanism. Is the maunder minimum or whatever the long period of no sunspots, is that somehow affecting our agriculture and the lack of good agriculture? Is that creating a depression? I could see a coupling mechanism there, but I haven't heard anyone saying we're getting a whole lot of crop failure, so that doesn't correlate. Is it significantly changing the weather? Well, we've had a Hurricane Katrina, and that's contributed to our grief, but we've also had a really bad hurricane of 1939, but the stock crash was 1929. Was there a real bad hurricane in 1929? Well, you always get a significant number of hurricanes each individual year. Was that year worse? So I'd love to know the coupling mechanism, if there is one. Over to you, Mel.
I don't know. I just said it looked funny. I know somebody took the chart of sunspot cycles over the last, I don't know, a few hundred years, and the times of so-called recessionary periods fell into very similar to the grooves on those charts. When the solar count at that time was the lowest, it seemed like that we had a recessionary period in the financial end of the... it could be maybe a coincidence or whatever, but I can't see how sunspots have this kind of negative effect on the whole financial situation in the world even today. But all right, it was just an interesting, a interesting chart that I happened to show me, that was presented to me about how they more or less documented it, Dick. So, all right, shall I look for another one? Over.
Absolutely. Let me show you one other thing, though. You got to be careful. Lots and lots of people believe that if I have socks that are damp and I get a cold chill in the back of the neck, I'm going to get the thing called a cold, the disease called a cold. And everyone can remember, gee, I had a cold a month ago, and sure enough, yeah, I had that draft on the back of my neck where I was working for a few hours. That must have caused it. Yet all the times you get a draft and wet feet and whatever, that you don't get a cold, we forget about those. They've, from time to time, done experiments where you take a whole bunch of volunteers, divide them into two groups, have one group live under really terrible conditions where you think you're going to get a cold, and other group live normally. And at the end of the experiment, you find out the people that were living under terrible conditions had some colds at a slightly lower rate. Doesn't easily correlate. We use selective memory when it comes to what causes a common cold. A common cold is you being exposed to that particular virus, and there's a zillion of them, and your body was not prepared for that particular virus. And so does a chill in the back of the neck create it? Very unlikely. Now, live under severe conditions like that, and could you get pneumonia? Yeah, I'm going to go for that one. But common cold, I sort of doubt it. So there's lots of situations like that where we use selective memory and we think there's a correlation. Because you're getting a sunspot cycle every 11 years, you've got a whole lot of opportunities for that to appear to correlate with the depressions in the financial world. I'm not sure there's a real easily explained coupling mechanism there. You got to know.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, the way they showed it, that's the number of the cycles, solar cycles, like when one was ending, the other one was beginning, and we haven't had that. We've had a severe, propagation in the last more than 2 years now. We've been sitting on the bottom of the solar cycle and haven't seen any inroads on the new cycle, cycle 24. Cycle 23 is just about gone, and cycle 24 has not really begun to any extent. Almost no sign of it so far. So they said, well, they showed that in past times like that, one of the most severe setbacks they said they had, they showed what it was, famine and everything went on, was between around 1615 to 1725, when that was no solar count was shown to appear of sunspots. And there was a terrible famine in parts of the world, Asia, parts of that. China went through a terrible situation and whatnot. And I don't know, they just showed how it seems like the sun is somewhat controlling the system. But I doubt it very much. I think it may be just a lot of coincidences, or maybe, I guess you can maneuver around anything, Dick, if you want to figure out how to, use it as a possibly prophesize something, Dick. I have my doubts on it. Let me get another one next.
In that case of that 1615 or whatever was more than the minimum, where there was a very extended period of time of no sunspots, because our weather is such a delicate balance, it appears as though the solar constant did go down for a couple of years, and it lowered the Earth's temperature only a couple of degrees, but that's all it takes to give you weather shifts and crop failures, agricultural failures. So that one I sort of believe, Mel, that more than the minimum did give us a miniature ice age, so to speak, for about a decade or so. That one I sort of believe, and I think that one's been reasonably well documented. Over to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Yes, so, and they linked it, of course, I guess, during times of that sort. They no doubt will affect somewhat the monetary system. So I assume that's possibly, the two sort of, situation. All right, I'm looking here. Let's see. On 160 meters. Gee, I got a lot of questions that came in on 160 meters. I have listened to 160 meters, this one person asked, many a time I never hear anything on it. Is it possible that you do need a sensitive antenna system of some sort that cannot, you know, in other words, that it's not possible to hear 160 meters under normal circumstances? Please tell me about some antenna options for 160 meters. Now, what can I say about 160 meters? Yes, I've been doing, again, some experimentation, listening, and it does perform unusual. A few nights back, I was on 160 meters. 40 and 80 were very quiet, and 160 was good. A lot of DX coming through it on it and all. And it sometimes is a surprising why 160 meters. Why does it perform sometimes completely opposite or from what you would expect on a band that you would think not too far away, like 80 meters. But for some reason, 160 meters does have its own head, its own style, its own, I don't know, its own way of doing things, Dick, that is quite different, over.
I like it. Anybody who wants to experiment with 160 meters has to admit going into it, it is a pretty tough band. A half-wave dipole on that band, the standard antenna that Mel and I often use as a basis for comparison, a half-wave dipole at 160 meters, in theory, is 263 feet long. Not an easy antenna to establish if you don't have quite a bit of real estate or you're pretty smart about making ways of using your small amount of real estate with electronic trickery of some kind. But now, if you're really interested in that band, there's a two-step process. Admit that establishing the right kind of an antenna that's going to be efficient as a transmitter is going to be hard. But establishing an antenna that's going to be good enough as a receiver is easy. So for you to just listen to what's going on with 160 meters, Mel can tell you how to make a relatively easily fabricated loop antenna that you can locate in the shack with you. And the advantage of the relatively small physical-sized loop antenna that once you resonate it, because it's a thing that you can fit into the room with you, you can now tilt it in azimuth and elevation and physically rotate it so that you can rotate polarization. Now you can listen to any signal that's present. And here at first it sounds, let me drop, it sounds like a violation of reciprocity. However you build an antenna, it's got to be able to transmit and receive the exact same way. The very forgiving nature of the lower frequency bands is that a receiving antenna is very forgiving. Your receiving antenna may have a 3% efficiency because it's so small. But because the noise on the band is so high and the noise dominates, a 3% efficient antenna means that you're, let me pick a number, 15 dB down on receiving the signal, but you're also 15 dB down on receiving the noise that's on that band. And the two come out even. Transmitting into that little loop antenna, maybe no one's going to hear you 1,000 miles away. But to receive, if you want to receive 160 meters, consider a small antenna that is adaptable, and you can wave it around in polarization and azimuth and elevation, and because of the crazy thing the ionosphere does for that signal, and it changes day to day, you can adapt to what the ionosphere is doing this particular hour and listen to those signals. So I strongly recommend that if you're interested in that band, get or build a converter or buy a receiver that'll listen to it. Build one of Mel's loop antennas to start listening. I'll admit that when you want to transmit to it, you've now got a second hurdle to go through, but I'll bet you with not very many dollars and not a whole lot of real estate, you can build an awfully high performance receiving antenna for that band. And that also goes for the 150 kilohertz band, if that's the one you want to listen to. And guys have done that with a small loop in their backyard that they put on the picnic table. Give me a couple of words on loop antennas, and do you think it's very buildable to build one at 160 meters, Mel? K2KEY, K2LAW.
Yeah, no doubt, you can build it. The problem is, it is a little bit hard to turn it around, one for 160 meters in the shack, because if you just look at, of the antenna that's, you can look in the antenna handbook, and they they have the receiving loop. I've just pulled out the book, in fact. The receiving